how to start?
Well, you know, it's just writing. I mean,
here's something important to remember about dialogue.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
I want to go to this place that I think it needs to go to.
The only thing that counts is what you see on the screen.
I will write like 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
And it will be a voice made of ink and rage.
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Welcome back to the show. In this episode, I sat down with Emmy-nominated screenwriter Michael Jamin, who's best known for King of the Hill, Just Shoot Me, Beavis and Butthead, Wilfred, Marin, Rules of Engagement, and recently Tacoma FD. We also talk about his new book of essays, A Paper Orchestra, which recounts the true stories of a sensitive, anxious man searching for the things that are most important: identity, love, forgiveness, and redemption. We talk about how he started his career, his new book, the reason behind building a social media following, his thoughts on AI, and much more. Here's my conversation with Michael Jamin.
So, yeah, I mean, as a kid, I always wrote, even like in grade school. And then in high school, I loved Cheers. And I thought, well, what if I wrote the lines for Norm? Could I get that job? That's not how it works, but that's what I thought. And then even in college, I remember there's an article, it might have been in Vanity Fair or something like that. And it was about the writer's room for Cosby. And I was like, wait a minute, that's a job. And so then I realized, okay, I'm going to see if I can get a job like that.
What was kind of the first step, though? Because usually that's what people see, is like they don't even know it exists and they kind of try and do it. Did you go to school for it? Did you just start writing specs? Like what time period were you in as well?
Oh, so I went to college. This is I graduated in 92. And so, no, I didn't study screenwriting. I have a degree in English literature. I tried to get into the creative writing program and I was rejected twice. And so I really felt like they were shutting. At 19, you know, and I really felt like they were closing the door on my future. I really thought, I was under the impression I could do whatever I wanted as long as I studied hard, you know? And that's what you're told. I graduated Princeton. And when you get into Princeton, you're thinking, oh, the world's my oyster. And they're saying, no, not in that one thing. And so I wound up getting my roommate recommended I get an internship at a radio station down the street on Witherspoon Street. And I thought, well, you know, because radio is like TV, maybe that's a stepping stone. And it's not. But I thought, this, what did I know? And so I wound up working there briefly. And everyone who worked there hated it. They hated being there. And I thought, if I stay too long, I'm going to hate it too. But there was a woman, a matronly woman, and she was in her 60s, and she took a shine to me. And she was the host of a social, she was like a socialite. She had a call-in show. And it was called Princeton's Talking, but it sounded like Princeton's Stalking, like a call rate for, you know, for serial killers. And that was actually one of the stories that would later become one of the stories in my book about how, as a kid, I was told I can't be a writer, and my unlikely friendship with her, which kind of inspired me to become one anyway.
Did you feel like even the screenwriting courses, did they seem too serious? Like, were they leaning towards drama? Because, I mean, you're known for comedy. We're always trying to write comedy. Did you feel that way, even trying to kind of break in that way?
Well, I didn't take screenwriting. I didn't study screenwriting in college at all. So I moved to L.A., and then I studied. I wanted to be a comedy writer, and I found I wanted to learn from someone who actually was a comedy writer. So I found a guy who had since retired. And that's all I wanted to do. And so I learned the art, you know, of screenwriting. I managed to, I teamed up with a guy, and my partner and I wound up getting staffed on a show called Just Shoot Me. And we've been working ever since.
What made a partnership right for you? Because sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. A lot of it's intangibles. But what did you see as like the strengths of going that route?
That's actually another story in the book. But basically, he's a very talented writer. We were both represented by the same agent. And rather than compete against each other, we're like, let's just team up and write. And it's like a marriage. You know, you have to fit well together. You have to have some similar sensibilities. And we've been writing together for, you know, 30 years or so.
What was tell me like some of the other highlights. So like what happened after Just Shoot Me? How did you kind of meet Mike Judge and some of the other points of your career?
Well, once you're in, like the hardest job you get is the first one. And then, you know, we had an agent. And so our agent submitted us to King of the Hill. They were hiring. It was actually Paul Lieberstein, who was a writer on King of the Hill. He became Toby on The Office. So he was a writer on King of the Hill. He left. And so they needed to hire a replacement. So we literally took his office. And that's how we got on King of the Hill.
How do they market you guys? Do they have a type of comedy that they describe you as when they're talking about like in those early days?
No, if you look at it, the shows I've done a broader range of comedy. Like Brickleberry is very, you know, juvenile. We did Marin and Wilfred, which are very sophisticated. Marin's a dark comedy. Like, no one gets hung up on that. It's like, if you were a writer, my job is to figure out the tone of the show and write in that tone. And so I'm happy to write whatever tone you have.
How do you kind of describe your own tone? Like in the book, was there something else you wanted to do that's different, which is unlike a staff writer, you're often trying to, you know, match the showrunners or the creator's perspective. How did you kind of find your own voice in the new book?
That's exactly right. And that was really hard because as a TV writer, and you said it perfectly, my job is to match the tone of the show. And the tone varies greatly from show to show. So I don't need to have a voice. My voice is the show, voice of the character is the voice of the show. And so when I've set out to write this book, I've always been a huge fan of David Sedaris, the author. I love his writing. And so I read everything that he wrote multiple, like 3-4 times. I studied him. And then when I set out to write my own collection of personal essays, which I don't like that title. I don't like the way that sounds, but essay sounds very serious, but it's not like that. They're just true stories. And so when I set out to write, I had to find my own voice. And that took, it took a while. It took several months before I found out, okay, the tone that I wanted to write in, it was a little intimidating at first. Like, how do I want to sound? Who am I inside? How do I sound? You know?
Were you an only child growing up too?
No, I have an older sister.
Okay. So I'm an only child. I've been trying to think, I love David Sedaris as well. I feel like a lot of memories for me are just so faded. Like I just read your story, Yellow Belt, this morning, because I also kind of took, mm-hmm. you took judo, but I took karate for 2 weeks and got a yellow belt. But I feel like, how did you go?
If you're yellow belt in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I think it was a pay scale kind of, as you mentioned. Yeah. I think we learned two moves and that was it.
Yeah.
But did you have any trouble, like the memory part of it? I know some things you have to fictionalize. Like you said, like the guy's name was probably Kyle, or you kind of add some humor to that as well. But how'd you go about just kind of like what stories to tell, what stories shape you? And then your subtitle, What If the Smallest Almost Forgotten Moments Were the One That Shaped Us Most? Was that kind of, when you figured that out, that helped you pick which stories to tell?
Well, I had a list of memories. I just wrote like every memory, you know, I have, and I don't have a terrific memory, but the ones that, the moments of my life that I remember obviously have an emotional attachment, or else I wouldn't have remembered them. And so if there's an emotion attached to the memory, then you might have a story. You might have enough to tell a story. And so that's how I started digging in. And so even though some of the dialogue I might not remember verbatim, I remember how I felt. I remember how the conversation went. So it's easier to write the dialogue.
What did you kind of study Sedaris and reverse engineer? Because I feel like he just journals everything and then he can kind of put it together. What was your process like that was probably different from his?
I studied him. I so appreciate his writing. And I can't say I ever cracked the code on how he did it. So I really had to rely on the way I have been a writer for TV. Most of my stories have a 3-act structure, which is very similar to writing to television. Most of them feel like 20 to 30 minutes long, which feels like an episode of television. So it's not that far of a departure. I just tried to go a little deeper than I'm allowed to do when I'm writing a sitcom. When I wrote this book, I didn't want people to think it was basically a sitcom or was written by a sitcom writer. I wanted to be deeper than that.
And sitcoms have kind of changed a bit too. Like sometimes we do expect a little more like pathos, I think, today too. Have you seen that change about your actual writing, your paid writing as well?
No, because I write what people pay me to write. And I'm happy to do that. So, but I don't get to decide. I don't write what I want to write. I write what people pay me to write or what I think I could sell. But when I was doing the book, I was like, no, I'm not taking the notes. I'm writing what I want to write. And to me, I think that's what was so exciting about it. It's like, you know, this is what I can do.
I try not to do this too much, but I want to dissect this story a little bit and kind of, you know, they say like you don't dissect the bird to hear the song. So you kind of have this story. You're, let's say like an innocent kid. You don't really want to go into this violent sport or anything like that. And you kind of end with this, like you're almost this caretaker of this little thing you built out in the woods. Can you kind of talk about some of the metaphors of this particular story or how you really bookended it like the way I would think of a TV show or a movie or something too?
Well, when I wrote it, so that story real briefly is about me. My dad, I wasn't a tough kid. My dad wanted to toughen me up. So he put me in judo lessons and we had a tournament and I was the wrong kid to be in judo classes. And at the tournament, I get the shit kicked out of me. And so it's all true. And I remember we were driving home that day, my dad's like, you know, we probably have enough of judo, don't you think? And I'm like on the verge of tears. And so that was kind of the end of the story as I was writing the early drafts. Each story has like 40 drafts. And so, but I always felt like I was missing something, and I wanted to know, strangely, I wanted to know what happened to that little boy. Was he going to be okay? Even though he was me, I wanted to know, was he going to be okay? And so around that same time of my life, I like to build these little twig huts, like outside my front, from the front lawn. And when it rained, I had a roof. So I was always picturing that the little creatures would come inside and hang out during the storm. And that was my little thing I did when I was that age. And so I thought, well, maybe that's how I should end the story, because I wanted to see if the kid's going to be okay. So the last scene is me building that little hut again and wondering if for the small creatures, so that the small creatures could feel safe again, which obviously refers to me. But was he? Would he feel safe? Because I don't think you can. I think after you go to an experience like that, you're changed in a small way. I don't think you can actually go back to who you are. But I asked that question, at least, for the reader.
What did you start to narrow the stories down? Was it because of the subtitle? Were you trying to go in a specific way? Is there a story that you was really close but just didn't make the cut?
Oh, God. I mean, so there's 17 stories in the book, but I wrote, well more than that. So many of them I felt, some of them I saved for my next book. I go, this would be better for the next collection. And some I felt, this is a really fun story. A couple of them are really fun, but they just didn't tonally match the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of like when I was early on, when I was trying to find my voice. So I liked them, it just didn't match. So I'd pull them out. And a couple of just, more than a few, were just, they just weren't that good. So I don't include them. They'll never be included. No one will ever read them. I just didn't think they were good enough. They didn't move me emotionally. I don't think they were going to move the reader. Even though they might have been really funny, but I always try to end my piece, like my work, with like, how can I hit you in the heart? And some of them just couldn't do it.
Do you remember when you kind of realized that? Because some writers, when they're young, they're so precious with every word. I know TV writing, it had to happen pretty immediately. Within TV writing, you had to start cutting everything to make what was best. Do you remember like a moment when you kind of realized that?
Several years ago, my writing partner and I sold a couple movies to 20th Century Fox. And on the last day, like they gave you notes, so many notes. That's all you're doing is getting notes. And that's fine. And we get notes. Okay, here are the notes. And on the last day, we had a meeting with one of the executives who was giving this notes. And she goes, I got to say, I really prefer to write. I really prefer working with TV writers as opposed to feature writers, because TV writers, they'll take the notes. They're happy to do it. It's all part of the process. We don't get all bent out of shape. And it's because that's how it works in TV. But when you're a feature writer, I feel, or at least she felt, you may work on one movie every year. And then you're so attached to this thing. This is your baby. But on TV, we were doing 22 episodes a year. You got to know, okay, fine. Sure, let's do it. Let's try a different way. It's less precious to you.
Tell me about some of your other work. Like, how did you decide that you wanted to start kind of teaching other people on social media and answering questions and some of that? How did that first come about?
Right. That's a good question. I have been posting on social media for about 2.5 years now, almost every day, just talking about what it's like to be a TV writer, how I approach writing and all that stuff. And so it was because when I was writing my book, it's a collection of, personal essays or a memoir or whatever. And my agent was like, in order to sell this book, there's some, the expression is platform drives acquisition. It's like, what does that mean? You need to have a platform. What's a platform? You need to have a social media following. Because why was anyone going to, who's Michael Jammin? Who's going to go in the bookstore and pull out a book by him off the shelf if no one's ever heard of him? So I was like, fine. Give me a year, I'll put together. And so that's how I do it. That's how I have an audience.
It probably would be like, if they'd done the other route, it would say like from the writer of or something on the book, where you have kind of built this platform for yourself. Yeah. When did it start to click? Did you change something? Was it more about you answering like questions from people? Like did it start to rise right away in terms of like following and stuff like that?
I had no expectations. Like first I started posting on TikTok and I really thought I was going to be, I'd never been on the app. I'd never used it. I'd never used Instagram either. And I always thought it was just like, isn't this the app where we see like, high school girls shuffle dancing? Am I going to be the creepy old man on the app? And it turns out I'm not. I mean, there are plenty of people just sharing their lives of all ages. And it's all, it's interesting. But I was surprised at how quickly it grew. And I was surprised that anyone had cared what I had to say. All of it was surprising. And then when I started performing, because I started performing this as a one-man show, and I'd go on social media, hey, I got a show here. Anybody want to buy tickets? And I was surprised people would fly from across the country to see my show. I was like, this is very odd. It's unusual, but that's how it's done now.
I mean, where you've been a joke writer, was it easier for you to make something, you know, that small, 30 seconds, a minute, where a lot of coaches and writers have trouble like taking what they do and making it kind of bite-sized for social media?
Well, most of my posts are around like 3 minutes long, so which is, that seems to be the ideal length. But it's also about, what's the point of this? Get to the point. When I'm writing a TV show, you got a remote. I know you have a remote in your hand, and I know you're anything but my show is what you want to watch. So when I'm writing it, I have to keep it moving to keep it compelling. So it's the same way when I do these videos. It's like, keep it moving, because these people got, they're ready to do that.
The format you're at now, at least, it's like you kind of show the question, you kind of repeat it, give the answer. You have a very direct, like, I know what the payoff's going to be the instant I see it. Is that kind of what has worked for you the most? Would you describe it that way or a different way?
No, I mean, that could be many of them. I sometimes wonder when I see other people posting and they don't get to the point. I'm like, guys, get to the point. They're doing this. They're ready to do that. And so I write the same way as I do these posts. It's like, when you're reading my book, I want to make sure I give you a reason to turn the page, because you're anything else, you know, I don't want you to be distracted. I want to keep it compelling. And so I'm always writing with you in mind, the viewer, the audience, you know, the reader. So it's the same kind of thing, I feel.
For some of those where they're asking questions, do you choose those based on some data perspective or more about just what's interesting?
Listen, I thought I was going to run out of questions when I first started doing this. I was like, I'm going to run 3 days and I'm done. I'm going to have nothing left to say. And I'm always surprised that people come up with different questions that I haven't answered yet. And so I try not to repeat myself, because I feel like I don't want to alienate the people who've already followed me and watched. I don't want to make them sit through it again. But I also want to answer questions that I think are interesting, that might attract new people. And so that's my criteria. I'm not studying any analytics. I'm just trying to keep it entertaining for myself, because I don't want to get bored by doing this.
What's some of the most like common questions you're getting right now at this point in time?
Well, a lot of people want to know how do I become a screenwriter? Do you have any tips for screenwriting? And I'm like, what do you think I'm doing here? If you have to ask that question, just scroll, just come. It's free. Come enjoy. Do I have any tips? That's all I have. Just watch. That's all I want to tell you.
What are some of the questions you're getting around AI? Because that seems to be a big thing people are asking about.
Well, right now the Writers Guild has successfully, we went on strike over that so that the studios couldn't replace us with AI. So I haven't been on a show yet where we started using it. To me, AI is a tool that no one in the industry was asking for. No writer was asking for. I think, you know, so I also feel whether or not AI can write compelling stories, I don't know. We'll find out. It's not there yet, but I think that's the plan. Hopefully, I mean, I think they're hoping it will get there. So I would be interested to hear a story about AI describing what it's like to be AI, if it gets consciousness. Like, what is it like to be a computer? Tell me, do you aspire to be a human? Are you not? Like, what do you want, AI? But when AI tells a story about the human experience, that's just bullshit, because AI is not human. It's just going to, I don't care. I find it creepy, and I don't think it won't connect with me, because I know it's just an algorithm. And I also know I get creeped out when I'm thinking about buying blue sneakers, and the next thing you know, I'm seeing ads for blue sneakers. If you think that's creepy or weird, hang on. I think there's gonna be part of you that is gonna be weirded out, because the whole point of this AI is to make custom stories just for you. We know how you like your story, so that's what we're gonna give you. Like, get out of my head. I don't want that.
Where do you think, like, because when I've tried to use it some more for research, it's like come up with 10 bad ideas or something like that. But like, let's say you're using it to like, you know, make a very specific joke on a Mike Judge type comedy. Would you say the quality is also not there? Or how do you kind of see like where people are even trying to use it?
I haven't seen the quality there yet, but that's not to say it can't get there. But those of us in the industry are not clamoring for it. We are right. This is what we want to do. Here's the thing. If I wanted to be a race car driver, I'd study race car driving. I wouldn't get into a Tesla and put it on autopilot and then just sit back and I'm a race car driver now. Like, that's just not what race car driving is. That's something else. So I it's not something that I feel like writers, professional writers, are clamoring for.
Tell me, we mentioned a lot of different things already. What does your given time look like now? Are you working on a couple of different shows? Are you writing spec scripts? Are you focused on the book? Are you focused on social media? Do you just see a variety of things you're doing right now?
Well, my partner and I have an animated pilot we're doing. We're shopping two other projects soon. The industry is a little slow right now, so we're waiting for things to pick up, the buying to pick up. In the meantime, I timed it perfectly with my book. So I'm just promoting my book, and that I really hope to be the next chapter of my career, is basically writing more of these and then tour, because I tour with it. And so where I perform a show based on it. So I'm excited to do more of this. To me, it's just, it's different from what I've been doing for 28 years. So I'm excited about it.
So you mentioned some of these stories, you might have like 40 drafts and you're performing to some degree. Are you doing kind of what Sedaris does, where he like makes edits on the spot? How does that help? How does that immediate feedback help, if so?
I don't quite do it the way he does. I mean, I know he jots down notes. When I'm doing it, I've already performed it so many times in rehearsal. The part of the benefit of being a television writer is that, we do these table reads and we see things over and over again. So I feel like I'm able to judge my work before I share it too much, before I have to go public. I know the cadences. I'm kind of good at, that's just my experience. So that's not to say I don't make notes at a performance. Like, I'll make a mental note, and I should tweak that a little bit. I have done a little bit of that, but usually by the time I'm performing it and you're giving me money for tickets, it's 99% there,
Did so much time writing personal work, did that change the way you think about future work at all? Like, do you want things that are more personally connected to you? That's kind of been adjusted?
Yeah, my best friend from high school recently died very tragically. And so I've been working on a piece basically to honor him, a piece about our friendship. And I know it'll be powerful. And I know, I'd rather have him alive, but at least writing it is a way for me to, mourn and process my grief of losing him.
And that's prose or like a spec script?
It'll be another story for my next book.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You kind of like built the audience, built the platform, writing the book comes out. Have they encouraged you to do anything differently thinking about second books? Or how do you think, do you want to do anything or any adjustments, or is it just more of the same and this is what you plan to do?
It's more of the same. I mean,
I mean that like in the best way. I don't mean like in a bad way or anything.
People ask me if I'm going to write a sequel, but sequel is not quite the right word because it makes it sound like it's just chronological. I'll write stories from my past that have happened, 20 years ago. So for my next book, but I do want to keep doing more of it. Like David Sedaris, he's got a ton of these books like that. And each one I find so interesting. And they're all just, if you ask me which is my favorite, I don't know, because I don't really remember which story goes to which book. It's just their collections,
Is there anything logistically you're doing differently? Or are you like kind of, as memories come up, are you writing them down more? Do you already carry things or write in your phone? Or how do you do some of the things when you're not in the office?
I just, I'll write a note in my phone, or sometimes I'll text myself a line or something. And so that's how I keep track of it, so I don't lose it. But I'm always looking. I was back where I grew up. I hadn't visited my hometown in many, many years. So I was back there over the summer, and I went back just to my old high school, just because I was looking to pick up stories. I was looking for memories to write about. And I took my daughter there, and I was just so, I don't know if I have a story there yet, but it was just so surprising how small everything felt. I mean, I guess it's kind of common, but I'll probably examine that a little bit about how small things felt and how big. Back then my problems felt so big. And now when I look at it, I go, but it was so small.
I wonder if it makes you, does it make you want to do anything differently? So I interviewed this guy, Nick Brown. He's a writer now. He was in a band, like a pretty big or one hit wonder kind of thing in the 90s. And writing it's more of a memoir though, as opposed to essays, but writing his memoir, he's like, well, I got to go kind of get the band back together to be able to finish the book. Have you felt anything like that about it?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, right? That's one of the things about being a writer, is that how it can enrich your life, is that because I'm always looking for stories, I'll do stuff that I wouldn't ordinarily do, knowing I can get a story out of it.
And that seems like the, because Sedaris asks odd questions to strangers. Like that has to be what he does most of the day, right?
I know. Yeah. He's such a curious guy. And I don't have that kind of curiosity. So,
yeah.
No.
Any other advice for, you know, kind of a broad question, any other advice for up and coming writers today? I think being a TV writer helps you be less precious, write under deadlines, write more often. I think like quantity leads to quality to a degree.
I agree.
What are some of your lessons for people kind of up and coming today and in all fields of writing?
It's funny. I just did a post about that today. So I have all my props here. When I was a kid, Neil Simon was the guy. I wanted to write like him. He wrote, you know, amazing plays and including Brighton Beach memoirs. And I remember he also wrote one called Lost in Yonkers and Biloxi Blues. And I remember thinking, man, if only how come I couldn't have been in the army and had an insane drill sergeant, then I could have written Biloxi Blues. And how come I couldn't have grown up in Yonkers, then I could have written Lost in Yonkers. But, you know, obviously my life is not interesting enough. Here's the thing. I grew up a half mile from the border of Yonkers. My friend Eric lived in a house on the border. I would walk to his house. And then a few years ago, the New York Times did one of these online quizzes where you could enter like how you pronounce certain words. And then we'll tell you, geolocate what area of the country you grew up in. And my accent is Yonkers. And yet, for some reason, as a child, I didn't think because I didn't live in Yonkers, I didn't grow up there, I couldn't have anything to write about, which is so silly, of course. And so that's why what I've explored in the book is like, hey, we all have these little stories. Your stories don't have to be mine. The question is, how do we figure out, or how do I figure out how to unpack the details of that story and tell them in a way that everyone finds compelling? So we all have these stories. You just have to learn how to dig them out.
Yeah, it almost seems like we're blinded by them. I saw the show Mayor of Easttown, and it's so specific to that area. But it's like when you try to think of your own area, it's hard to like, what are the puzzle pieces? It's almost like you can't see them for some reason.
That's exactly right. What are the puzzle pieces? Because that's what writing is. I meant to say that in the post, but I forgot. Was that writing is putting together the puzzle, and we all have a puzzle. You just have to put it together.
Well, where can everyone find you at? Like, where do you kind of do all your posting and that type of thing?
My social media handle is at Michael Jammin Writer. I'm on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, all the, you know, the big ones. And you can also visit my website, michaeljammin.com, and learn more about the book there. It's also available in print, ebook, and audiobook. The audiobook is a performance narrated by me.
Thanks so much for tuning into the show. Before you take off, I want to give you a free gift. I'm giving you my first book, Ink by the Barrel, for free. That's the digital download and audiobook at brockswenson.com. Inside this book, you'll learn how to annihilate writer's block by embracing Elizabeth Gilbert's playful trickster mentality. You can learn to weaponize your anxiety with Kevin Kelly's different is better approach, and learn how to defend your time with Ryan Holiday's calendar anorexia mindset. There's just a few other ideas in the book, Ink by the Barrel. It's also based on over 400 interviews I've done right here on Creative Principles. So go steal that book right now, Ink by the Barrel, to learn how to be a prolific writer. You can get your copy, that's digital download and audiobook, at brockswinson.com, brockswinson.com. And if it's your first time here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode.